New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos. You can now download a free PDF copy or purchase a beautiful printed edition of Issue 5 of the New Thinking Aloud magazine.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlov.
Hi, I'm Dr. Deborah Lynn Katz, and I'm a guest host on The New Thinking Aloud, produced by Dr. Jeffrey Mishlov. I'm really honored to be bringing to you a recent interview I did with none other than Dr. Roger Nelson. Dr. Nelson is the long-running director of the Global Consciousness Project, which was started at the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Research Laboratory, known as PEAR, P-E-A-R. Dr. Nelson has published a book on the Global Consciousness Project, and he also has published close to 75 papers on all sorts of parapsychology topics, including some of which we'll be discussing today. We'll also be talking about Dr. Nelson's early childhood experiences, what led him into parapsychology, how he got started at the PEAR Lab. He's going to talk about many of his own inventions, some which were patented, including those that have to do with micro-PK. And he's going to be talking about today what's happening with the Global Consciousness Project, some exciting developments, Global Consciousness Project 2.0. And he will also be sharing his views on the future and what he's most proud about in his long career in this field. And he is also going to talk about how he feels about spirituality and science and how those two can go together. All right, let's get started. Thank you for joining us. So just give us an introduction of yourself to start off with.
I was a curious kid. I went off looking for, I lived in a very small town in the middle of Nebraska, and I went off looking for books on judo and jiu-jitsu and martial arts and so forth in our local Carnegie Library, and I didn't find any, but in the process I did find a book on Hatha Yoga, which was, I think, instrumental in bringing me toward being a kind of human, I mean, a conscious human. I learned respect, actually, for something like religious or quasi-religious traditions and practices, because this book was written by people, one from the West, German, and one from India, and the two of them presented a kind of case for generosity of spirit and understanding of circumstances. For example, they said, a vegetarian diet is by far the best, but not if you're an Eskimo. If you're an Eskimo, you will need to eat some animal fat. Otherwise, you won't prosper. And I thought that's sort of recognition of living in the real world is something that we should aspire to. Yeah. So I have aspired to a kind of living in the real world ever since. Lots of time passed, and I did experiments in high school with using the methods of J.B. Rhine, and became persuaded that there could be science here because I got results that were positive, but they weren't overwhelming, they weren't spectacular, they were just statistically significant. And that made me think, okay, science is possible even in a very esoteric kind of domain. So I became first a physicist and then a psychologist, and then a professor of psychology in a small college where I wanted people to learn about research, how to do it and how to interpret it and how to think about these kinds of things that are kind of at the edge of what we understand. So I asked people to do, what do you want to do in your personal experiment? And there were two things that came up. This was in the mid-1970s. One of them was drugs, in particular pot. They wanted to do experiments where, you know, somebody was stoned, whatever. The other one was parapsychology. They wanted to do ESP and psychokinesis experiments. Nobody knew of remote viewing at that time by that name. But so that brought me back to this idea of consciousness being a kind of remarkable attribute that we hardly understand. We don't understand much about consciousness and what it's capable of. We know nothing about the edges. And that's where I have been attracted ever since, the edges of what we know.
Yeah, that's amazing that you started just when you were in high school with even doing some of J.B. Rhine's experiments. Do you recall how you first learned about his work at such a young age?
That same Carnegie Library, probably. At least I read the book called something like Parapsychology After 60 Years. It was written by Rhine and a co-author whose name I'm not sure about, maybe Pierce. And it was good. It was it recounted not only how the experiments came out, but how to do them, you know, what the details were. So that was perfect for a curious kid, now a high school kid.
What year did you graduate high school, if I can ask?
You were a gleam in somebody's eye, perhaps.
You went into physics. So how did you go from that into parapsychology? Can you talk about that journey?
Well, I was a good student, so I got scholarships to go to University of Rochester in New York and away from Nebraska, a long, far distant location. And I was a physics major at first, but then I became interested in sculpture. And I wanted more time for sculpture. And I didn't have enough time to do both physics and sculpture, so I switched and became a psychologist, which I imagined that I could do without studying. But I mean, it's kind of ridiculous. But I enjoyed the sculpture too much to worry over it. And in any case, I then, you know, I went through graduate school and I matriculated there as a perception and memory specialist. And my degree is in experimental psychology. And so I was teaching in this little college in Vermont for, I think, 8 years. And we are now in the mid-70s. And people as old as I am will remember that was not a good time economically. So there were threats to change the small colleges. I was part of a system of three, into something that I thought of as kind of like diploma mills that were designed to give somebody a degree for a job area that would probably be, you know, already filled by the time they graduated. Anyway, I really didn't want to be in a diploma mill situation. I like liberal arts education too much. I think it's better to learn how to learn than to take in a whole lot of details. And so a friend gave me a Chronicle of Higher Education, a classified sheet with some jobs circled that he thought I might be interested in. And adjacent to one of those was an advertisement for a cognitive scientist interested in the lesser known aspects of perception. And that intrigued me. It intrigued me also that it was at Princeton University, which I, you know, understood to be a great place. So I applied for this job, found out that the lesser known aspects wasn't the sense of smell or touch or something like that, but what turns out to be psychokinesis and remote viewing and that sort of stuff, you know?
That's a great word for it, lesser known perception.
Yeah, yeah. So I went to Princeton and talked with Bob John, who was the dean of the School of Engineering and setting up this program, with Brenda Dunn, whom you know also, I'm sure. And they needed a third person because the committee that was managing or monitoring what they were doing said so. And I was the third person. They were, didn't realize it at the time. There was a lot of competition for this job, and no wonder. It turned out to be an absolutely fabulous place to spend a long time. I lived in Princeton for 40 years and only recently moved to upstate New York. And 20 some years of that, I was in the PEAR lab, and the rest of the time, I continued the same line of work, but in the context of the Global Consciousness Project.
When you first started in the PEAR lab, what types of projects were you working on?
Okay, the first two things, they were kind of like everything came at once, which was I liked. But Brenda had been doing what she called remote perception, which is the same as remote viewing. And Bob was interested in that too. And my first job was to rationalize that and start working on what amounts to rigorous and analytical methods. And the team put together a way to be able to analyze and evaluate each session in a statistically sound way. I don't know whether you want details on that, but in any case, we then proceeded to do some 600 remote viewing trials, in which we were able to explore such things as how much does distance matter, and what about time? Is it possible that people can remote view tomorrow, even though the target hasn't even been selected yet? And among the findings that I think we can justly be proud of from PEAR is that those things don't matter. Distance and time are kind of immaterial in the remote viewing world. Right. It seemed really not to matter much. I don't think I said, but the agent at the scene would also maybe write something, but mostly fill out that questionnaire that I mentioned that the recipient did. And it was by matching those questionnaires and asking how well do they match up with each other. This is the simplest form of that we did. It had 30 questions there. Is it indoors or out? Are there straight lines or mostly curved? And a bunch of things like that. Are there living creatures in the scene or not? And so on. And so matching those up and doing the appropriate calculations, we were able to create a score for each of those trials. By comparing the immediate trial outcome with a background of all the same trials, the same pair of responses from the recipient and the agent, but from all of the ones which were not proper matches. In other words, we made a distribution of what it would be by chance, because by looking at all of the possible pairs, which are not actually the one that we're interested in for this trial. And that would give a distribution of Z-scores. And if the present trial had a big Z-score, it would be out in the tail of that distribution.
with the precognitive experiments, how did those protocols differ than the ones that were in present time?
Real time. So we had a drawer full of targets, photographs or descriptions of how to get to a certain area for things that weren't very far away, like, you know, within a couple of miles or a few miles. And you could draw one of those. At the time, the target was supposed to be visited by an agent. We always had two people. One was, we called the agent, who was at the scene and attempting to kind of present it for the remote viewing of the percipient who might have done this yesterday. So in that kind of protocol, the percipient would do the remote viewing of the target that's supposed to be seen tomorrow and fill out the, write some descriptions, draw some sketches and fill out our little binary questionnaire form. And then tomorrow, the next day at the time appointed, a selection would be withdrawn randomly from the target pool that we had. We did some on time and we did some post visitation or, you know, precognition and postcognition trials. And we're able to do, because we had this scoring system that allowed each trial to be evaluated and given a Z-score, we could do a regression on distance and a regression on time. And it turns out there was no significant decline in either, in space or time.
Did you personally come up with that? I recognize that's really the standard, the gold standard of analysis today in most free response studies.
It was created by the team. Bob was a physicist and a mathematician, very good experimental design person, not as educated in statistics as I was, but and Brenda had a kind of intuitive understanding that said if we compare the current real trial against a bunch of pairs of agent recipient responses that are not the current trial, then that should give us a reading. So it was a team effort.
So there's been some criticism of that method of statistical analysis, where it's sometimes considered a reductionist approach, where you've got the free response, the viewer or the participant is describing, they're sketching, they're giving lots of descriptions, and then it starts to get whittled down to basically, is it a hit or is it a miss? So 1 point per trial. But then do you find that the richness sometimes, for example, in one trial, the viewer or participant might have such a terrific description that's just mind-blowing, right? And then in another trial, they may get, you know, maybe some basic shapes or colors right, but, you know, not nearly as impressive in terms of specifics. But in the end, each one of those gets reduced down to 1 point.
I'm aware that, and we were all aware, Brenda and most in particular was deeply aware that if we go too far in this direction of what the critics you're mentioning think of as reductionist, we're likely to throw out the proverbial baby with the bathwater. But we didn't do that. Basically, we asked the recipient to lean back and we tried to be really encouraging about this and take in whatever's coming and floating into the space that you're in, and try to just relax and let it be, let it come to be. And if you want, draw pictures, if you want, write descriptions, only before you finish the job, fill out this little questionnaire. And most people did a pretty much all of that. Most people, you know, I can't speak for somebody's actual thought processes who was doing this, and I wasn't even there, right? But my own experience with it was to let things develop in a kind of, I was once a photographer, and if you develop photographs in a dark room, it's a remarkable thing. First there's nothing, then there's a little hazy pattern, and eventually you have a beautiful image. And so we tried to allow that. We tried to get everybody involved in these experiments, and also the other kinds of experiments, our mind-machine experiments. We tried to get everybody to kind of relax and allow things to happen.
Did you test just the general population, or did you have more select subjects?
We kind of specialized in the everybody approach as a matter of principle and kind of practicality. We had a couple of reasons for that. One thing was that we wanted to survey. We knew we were in this for the long run. We wanted to survey what the possibilities and capacities are of a general population. Of course, we had a rather selected population, people who knew about the lab and who were interested in this kind of stuff, right? They were the ones who came by and did experiments, and a lot of students. And so that's a very much narrower population than the whole. But we actively avoided, for the most part, anybody who claimed special powers, partly because those people tended to want to be confirmed rather than to learn something. We were much more interested in learning something.
Do you believe that everyone has these abilities, has intuitive abilities?
Yes. But it's that has to have a lot of, caveat stuff stuck on. Most people can't relax and let it be. And most Westerners, at least, are educated to believe such things are impossible. And one of the most brilliant demonstrations of the difference between people who can allow it and people who have a little trouble is watching kids at work. And we couldn't legally, so to speak, or according to the regulations, we couldn't really run experiments with children. It was too much trouble to get permission of all the parents and teachers and whatnot. But we had guests, classrooms full of 10-year-olds, for example, who would come to our laboratory to see what scientists do. Partly they came to us because they couldn't find any real scientists who had the patience to deal with kids. You know? So these kids, we had an experiment which we called the robot experiment. It had a little dome-shaped robot that had wheels and a motor, and we set it up with a random number generator to decide how far it would go and then how far it would rotate when it stopped and how far it would go the next time. And so it was set up, in other words, to drive around on a table with a passenger, which was a very cute what we called primordial frog. he was like super cute. And so the kids said, what's this experiment? And we said, what it's about is you try to get that frog and this robot Zamboni to come to you. And they would stand on one side of the table and say, come. And it did more often than it would for any adults. So that's not published, of course, but it's a fact. And it's a very fine demonstration of how real the effect is of conditioning and enculturation, changing people from the wide open of an 8-year-old or a 10-year-old to the possibilities of a great and wonderful world, to the adult form, which is closed in quite a bit. We've got tunnel vision as adults.
Would you say then if adults are really trying to stay more childlike and keep their minds open and those qualities, they'll have a better shot at accessing those abilities?
Yeah. They have a better shot at having a happy life. And of course, if you're in an experiment and you want to do well, it's nice to relax, let it be, and watch it happen. Yeah. I'll give you another example, which was very cool. One of the people that worked in the lab for some time liked doing the random number generator experiment, where you would sit in a chair, maybe a meter or 1.5 meters away from our great big random number generator box, which is like a big suitcase on a table, and try to get high numbers. The random number generator experiment usually had a trial of 200 bits. So the mean value was 100, plus or minus a range of plus or minus 7 as a standard deviation, roughly. And so the experiment had three conditions. One was get high numbers, one was get low numbers, and one was let it be a plain old random number generator doing what random number generators do. So she tried mightily. She tried very hard. She concentrated and thought deep thoughts, and I don't know what all she did, but she was not successful. She would typically not get high numbers and not get low numbers. And maybe she got good baselines, who knows? And she finally, after a really long patient time, she decided she was going to read a magazine. Screw it, you know, let it be. So she leaned back and read her magazine, having set the intention, right? And lo and behold, it went high when she was relaxed and reading her magazine with the high intention. And the low is the same. So in other words, when she gave up and started doing, you know, this kind of distracting task, she did very well.
That's not surprising. And that seems to go along with some of Ingo Swann's experiments, too, such as when he was trying to influence the heat thermometer with Gertrude Smidler, and he wasn't doing very well. And then over the lunch break, he stopped trying to influence it, and he just tried to tune into the mechanisms to understand how it worked, basically using his remote viewing skills. And at that moment, that's when he had the biggest effect.
Yep, I know about that. I mean, I knew Ingo and loved him. I didn't know that particular outcome, but I had the same experience myself when I in the early 90s, we finally had become able to do something I wanted to do from while I was still in Vermont, which is just have a continuous running random number generator and assign moments when you expected it to change. In other words, like set it up so now is a time when it should have a high number outcome or a low number. I went off to a retreat with Thich Nhat Hanh, a Buddhist monk, who was absolutely a wonderful man. And he did Dharma talks every day. And I decided that I would set my intentions for this now remote, 250 miles away from Princeton, a remote experiment with a random number generator. I would set my intentions during the Dharma talk. What happened was that at the beginning of the Dharma talk, I would set my intentions and then forget about it because the Dharma talks were captivating, deeply meaningful, etc. So I totally didn't think about random number generators or Princeton or anything like that. So when I got home, the protocol was to then provide the intentions that I had set to the analyst. They would be entered into the record, and it turned out that my intentions set in 250 miles away and mostly ahead of time, mostly for the time that the machine would be running later, hours or maybe a day later. They were almost all spot on. It was like 9 out of 10 times I hit directly. And I have no kind of high performance in my attempts to be what we call an operator in these experiments. That was it was fabulous. So it kind of confirmed two or three things for me. One is that distance doesn't matter. Two is that attention, in the sense of trying very hard to deal with it, you know, to affect the machine, that doesn't matter. It's not needed. And something probably along the lines of the spiritual qualities of a meditation and Dharma situation is probably conducive, to say the least. It's something like very important for us to understand. And we know this from other kinds of experiments, maybe not so much in remote viewing, although I know Stefan Schwartz, who's been doing remote viewing forever, he's a big fan of meditation, and probably, I wouldn't be surprised, encouraged people to use meditation as part of their, you know, shaping up for trials in remote viewing.
When speaking to longtime remote viewers, of which I'm one myself, but we found that when we're trying to just sit there and do a really good job or wondering what the target is, we're not doing so well. But when we forget about that and just, you know, start to tune in and get really curious about it and get excited about what we're doing and just want to enjoy the experience, that's when we do seem to really start to, you know, get into the flow and access that information. Do you think that it's a matter that your brain waves are switching over, or a matter of hitting different emotions or changing your energy, or a combination of all of them?
I would definitely say a combination of all of them, because I think it's very important to recognize that there are states of mind that are more conducive than others. You do want to be agitated or under stress. Those are, I mean, there may be exceptions to that. For example, in emergency situations, we often see psi work to the effect of helping mitigate the danger or whatever it is. We have all kinds of anecdotal evidence, mostly, that that's true. But if we're in a kind of experimental situation and not under a duress or not in danger, then I think we probably should do whatever we can to de-stress and get out of the mode of worrying or ego concerns of winning or losing and all that stuff. It's just, those are all distractions. What we really want is a kind of open-hearted intention.
And how would you achieve that in a lab where people can be so serious or the environment is so formal? Was there something you did at the Pear Lab to make people feel more comfortable? Or
did you have a chance to visit the Pear Lab?
I didn't, no, unfortunately.
It was designed to be about as, you know, homey and friendly as we could muster. For example, you came in, and it was designed to be a kind of living room, but a living room with fun toys in it, like the big, there was a huge orange couch, which was an interior designer donated to us. And we had large, very comfortable chairs for the people who were doing experiments. We called them Comforto the Incredible. I mean, that was actually the name of those chairs. And they were. I mean, they really kind of encompassed you and put you in a nice frame. There were stuffed animals all over the place, and then quite a few frogs. There's at some point early on, we became enchanted by frogs, when people learned that, they gave us lots of frogs and lots of pears. Anyway, and there was coffee and little tiny cans of juice and cookies and stuff like that, and basically welcome friends attitude in the lab. Sometimes we would have some sort of, I don't know, you might say formal visitor, and that person would be treated sort of formally. But even so, that we didn't hide the toys.
Just hand them a frog.
and a very important additional thing, which is probably implicit, is that we wanted people to feel like they were friends of the lab, that we were all, you know, working on the same wavelength. You know, we all had the same kind of thing in mind. Let's learn something and have fun while doing it. So it was a good, we had a big group of return visitors, yeah, friends.
Did you have any famous visitors that people would recognize, or who were some of your memorable visitors to the lab?
Yeah, we had quite a few famous people, I guess. I think that's the question. There were, I mean, some of our, some of the people who helped us with funding, for example, were Lawrence Rockefeller, who was a friend of the lab. He would stop in and visit a little, and a guy named Webster, who's not quite as famous, but a big industrialist in Canada. And Prince Hans Adam von Liechtenstein, who's a, you know, the head man of a small country in Europe. Quite a few people like that. And then Nobel Prize winners and other, not necessarily prize winners, but famous physicists like Eugene Wigner. There's a wonderful statistician whose name I'm blocking on at the moment, but a guy who created a whole lot of the statistics that that we enjoy nowadays. Like, he invented things like adaptive regression, just as an example.
Wow. And Rockefeller, what was his interest in these topics? Do you recall?
Well, he was interested in consciousness in a very broad sense. He was very much interested in UFOs and that kind of thing, as well as remote viewing as a practice, as a potential tool, valuable kind of tool. But he, along with James McDonnell, who is the McDonnell of McDonnell Douglas, they both were friends of Bob's. They were actually classmates, or 1 or 2 years separated from Bob John. So that was part of it. It was a friendship with Bob, but also they, like James McDonnell, really literally was interested in whether consciousness, especially consciousness in a highly powerful, stressed situation, like a pilot in a cockpit of a fighter jet, whether consciousness might affect the sensitive instruments. And he actually was one of the major funders for the beginning of the lab, among other things, investigate whether we needed to worry about, a pilot who's just heard from his wife that she's more interested in another man or something. You know, is he going to be all right? Is the plane going to be all right?
Did you find any evidence to show that we should be worried about the phone calls that pilots are getting?
I would say it depends on how you define worried. But yes, I mean, the results in our lab, and as you know, all kinds of other labs, show that the mind is not confined to the skull. It reaches out and touches the world, and it can change the way the world is a little bit. So we set up experiments with random number generators because they're labile. They have the possibility of changing midstream. Their future is completely indeterminate. And so if, in principle, if information is provided by a consciousness that is seeking to structure what's going on with the random sequence, it can happen. And that means, in effect, that all sensitive instruments are, in principle, subject to some potential influence from consciousness.
We'll talk about the random number generator, but I'm first curious, were there other types of experiments you did for PK, and specifically more macro experiments?
Yeah, we had, I mentioned we had this big machine we called Murphy. This proper name was a random mechanical cascade. It was 10 feet tall and 6 feet wide. It had 3/4 inch polystyrene marbles that were brought up through a conveyor to the top of the machine and then allowed to dribble through a matrix of pins that were, you know, sticking out from the background and bouncing from left to right. And we had people sitting on this comfortable giant couch across from Murphy. The name comes from the conveyor belt and the counters. And if anything can go wrong, it will. Murphy is now reincarnated in Broughton, England. The Broughton estate in England has all of the Pear toys and documents. It's a fabulous last act for the Pear Lab. Anyway, that machine had, you could say, it's pretty likely, it really looks macroscopic. We have these balls, they're this big, they bounce on pegs that are the same diameter, back and left and right, and people try to get them to bounce more to the left or more to the right in our experimental design. It turns out I did some high-speed photography, and I was able to photograph occasional moments when a ball would bounce not just once before deciding to go left or right, but twice. In a couple of instances, three times. So it bounced, 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 and then finally we decide to go. So if you think about that deeply, you can recognize that even though this is a truly macroscopic, it's a huge machine, and the balls are macroscopic, no question. They're not electrons. Nevertheless, what we're talking about is information. Do I decide left or do I decide right? So it's like... It's not a terribly important thing in the long run, I guess. But so we didn't have the kind of things that people talk about in poltergeist situations. We didn't try to do experiments like that. But we did have a pendulum with about a 2-inch diameter crystal ball as the bob. It was suspended on a silicon crystal rod, which had no coefficient of expansion, basically, and it was swinging back and forth inside of a box, and it wasn't evacuated, so there was air, and the air would, if you let the thing go, the air would gradually slow it down, and we asked people to try to keep it from slowing down or increase the speed with which it would slow down as changing the damping rate, and we measured the damping rate by having a double razor edge cut a photoelectric beam as it was passing through a counter. And so we were able to measure, and the counter used for that was measured in 50,000, nanoseconds. So we were able to see the difference between one swing and the next swing, we were able to record. So that's macroscopic, or so it seems. But the turbulence of the air, that may be what's affected, or at least it would matter. If the ball is going through the air, causing a lot of turbulence, then it would slow the ball down, that sort of thing. So again, it's debatable whether that's really macroscopic, but it sure feels like it. You're sitting in front of this beautiful plexiglass. The thing belonged in an art museum, and now I guess in Broughton it looks like that. Anyway, we tried a variety of different things that were, in some sense, macroscopic.
How are the results on those two?
Well, on the Murphy, in the random mechanical cascade, the difference between going right and going left was highly significant. Even though both of them tended to go in one direction, one went much further in that direction. And in the pendulum experiment, we didn't run a long enough. Wait a minute. Oh, we did, actually. We had significant results in that also. People were able to increase the damping rate or decrease according to the instruction. So, yeah. We had a couple of other beautiful experiments that were, I mean, physically beautiful. One was a Crookes tube. It was evacuated. It had nitrogen gas, but of extremely low pressure. We had a big vacuum pumps on it, and then high voltage electricity across from top to bottom going through this gas. And by tuning it appropriately, you could get little globes of luminescence that would float up and down. And if you were as like nutty as I am about tuning things, you could get it to have 7 of those luminous globes floating up and down in the tube. And the experiment asked people to change the height of the column of luminous globes.
That must have been beautiful. And how were results for that one?
We never were able to run a formal experiment because it was just too difficult to control to have a kind of stable baseline. So, you know, in most of the experiments, we were able to figure out a way to do like the RMC, the random mechanical cascade. The pins were of nylon. Nylon is hydrophilic. So they, depending on the humidity, they would become less and more bouncy or flexible. And so we had to do something to compensate for that. We couldn't run a left going one day and right going the next day. We ran them adjacent to each other, and the statistics looked at the difference between these adjacent runs. So we were able to compensate. We weren't able to do that with the Crookes tube. So it was a beautiful, wonderful, hopeful kind of experiment, but it never did produce formal data. We had a couple of others. One was a tiny fountain, which had a sort of a thin, don't know what you call it, spigot, out of which a fine stream would go up, and then eventually it would break and scatter, fall down as a rain, as drops, droplets. So what we had was a laminar and then ultimately a turbulent flow. And the mathematics of laminar to turbulent flow are something of great interest. But so we would ask people in that experiment to try to change how long it stayed laminar before it broke up into the turbulence, or try to get it to break up quicker, as usual. Again, that one was too difficult to maintain stability, so we never had a formal database. They were promising those kinds of things, but they just couldn't do it.
Would you find that some individuals just right away seem to have an effect, like just as soon as they would even look at it?
Not to my knowledge. I don't really think so. Once in a while, we would have something that we would think of as a kind of unique moment. Like we had an interferometer experiment that had sodium light, which is yellow, going through a system that that split the light into two halves. One half would go straight ahead and one half would be bounced. And the two, when they were combined, would interfere with each other and made a target-like set of circles, which was very beautiful. And it was very difficult to control. We did things like close up the place, turn on a 200-watt light bulb in there when there were no people, and then bring in the experimenter and the operator and turn off the light bulb because the temperature was extremely important. But sometimes it would just be sitting there running. We had a visitor who turned out had to have a sort of a unpleasant background disposition. I won't go into the whole long story, but basically, while that guy was there, this interferometer, it was sending signals to a chart recorder. It was going, whoa, whoa, whoa. I don't like this. There was something also that had to do with the president of the university who was not a friend of the lab. It also made a remarkably powerful deviation when he visited the lab. Yeah. But these are not experimental things. It's not the sort of thing you can publish. We were always interested in having a controlled experiment with results that you could rely on and therefore interpret. Yeah. And it's very hard to do that with these fabulous moments.
With the president walking in, or the other guy with not a very good disposition, it'd be hard to say, like, is the machine just reacting to them like others would, or is the machine picking up on how you would be reacting to them?
Yeah, it's a good question, and we have no idea which it is of those. I do know that we didn't, when the guy was, he had a dog, and the dog was closed into his truck, and we thought that was unfortunate. That guy, we didn't have any idea that the machine was reacting at all. We only noticed it after he left. You know, we went in. So the president thing, I'm not sure. I think we might have known by this time that a distinctive visitor might create distinctive reactions on the part of our interferometer. It was beautiful, that machine. I loved it. But yeah, there you go. We had a lot of those.
And would you actually be the one to build the machines yourself, or would other people?
No, we had a team. It was mostly two of us. John Bradish was an electrical engineer and extremely gifted mechanically also. And I'm not bad mechanically. And I'm also aware of what's needed for the experiment and that sort of thing. So the two of us often work together to do that kind of design. We had an experiment that was created originally and built by a physicist in Toronto, I think, who wanted to see if he could, show the same kind of effects that we saw. And so he set up this experiment with a double slit ran the experiment in Toronto, and he said, I'm sorry to say that we are getting no effects at all, and if you guys are interested, I'll bring the machine down. And so he did, and then John and I went to work on this machine, which it was poorly done. It's like cooled electronics, and it wasn't cooled properly. So we made sure that was done right, and a bunch of other things. There were like lots of little mechanical things that weren't done right. And maybe you could get some kind of data out of the machine, but we wanted it to be clean and neat and understandable. So we rebuilt it and made it into a beautiful machine. And guess what? We got results at the level of significance. I'm not sure that was published, but it might have been. Yeah. His name was Stan Jeffers. He's dead now, but mode of experimentation. Remember, you asked about how we provided a comfortable environment. Stan Jeffers' idea of the appropriate experimental environment was a tightly closed room and lab coats. And so, as Brenda put it, we're more oriented toward the turban than the lab coat.
That does bring up a good point, though: individual differences and preferences. Not everyone's going to be thrilled with stuffed frogs all around.
That's very, very important. I think, you know, people worry over experiment effects, and sometimes there are some people, I think, who feel inclined or feel convinced by their experience somehow that all the psi experiments are just experimenter effect results of precognizing the future and determining that from the data in the future when you should push the button in order to get that. I think that's so convoluted it's nuts. But a lot of people think in those terms. And so I think what I personally believe is that there are numerous components, and the world is not as simple this and then that. It is not a simple cause and effect kind of relationship between two variables. Instead, we have a complex. We have the experimenter. We have the question the experimenter is asking. What sort of a question is it? What's the nature of the question? And then we have the nominal subject, as many people say, or operator, as we would say. And then I think there's a very important fourth ingredient, which I think of as a coyote. The Southwest Native Americans refer to the coyote as a kind of trickster, who is, in my mind, a representative of the universe saying, don't get all wrapped up in your hubris. You've got a lot to learn. So the universe laughs at us and tries to keep us humble. So that's one of the reasons that, well, that's one of the components of the experimental result. The nominal source, the experimenter, nature of the question, and the universe keeping us humble.
I just have a couple more questions about the way past, and then we'll move into talking about more of the present. So I was curious, how did the rest of Princeton University relate to your lab and your work? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I can talk about it. It was, we had friends among the faculty and officers of the university, but we also had enemies. They were basically people who were afraid that the reputation of this department or the school or the university would be sullied somehow by having these sort of weirdos doing crazy stuff in the basement of the engineering school. And unfortunate in one particular way, I think, especially. Bob liked experimental work, but he was not only the dean or had his professorial duties, but he was the main fund gatherer and the main defender of the lab. So he had to spend an unfortunate amount of time dealing with these attacks from people who didn't even have the courtesy to visit the lab before they made their attacks. So, I mean, that was in one sense, it kind of hampered him from being hands-on in the lab quite as much as he might have liked to. But I think it disappointed him more. It made him feel a sadness about this great university that didn't have the courage of a true intellectual presence. He was very much saddened by that.
Yeah, because it wasn't like they were visiting the lab or that they were reading your studies. They were just protesting on grounds of the subject overall.
It wasn't somebody at Princeton, but there's a fairly famous remark made by some eminent scientist, might have been Helmholtz, in the 1800s. He said, "I wouldn't believe this even if it were true." Can you imagine that? And a lot of the skeptics, both inside and outside the university, have a kind of materialist conception of the way the world is, such that if they do not see a possibility of explaining it by the known physics, then it cannot be possible. You know, and that's just stupid. You know, if you cannot read the data, if you cannot do the experiments, and yet want to make a pronouncement like that, I think you're lost. You're no longer in the academic intellectual. You're not honorable, really, in the intellectual academic world.
It's really deceitful, and especially if they're putting it out that they're speaking on behalf of science.
Oh my, yes. But it's worse than deceitful. It's something like self-destructive. They are actually ripping away a part of their soul, and they don't even know it. I'm sorry.
And it sounds like you really, as much as you've been focused on research, you really do come at this from a spiritual approach. Can you talk about that?
In this context, I can talk about that. In the context of what do you do? I have to first say I'm a scientist, a data scientist. There are a couple of things. Most people are inculcated and indoctrinated and so forth by the experiences of life and education to become good scientists, right? Well-behaved scientists. But I escaped. I don't know how exactly. It may have been that finding that yoga book when I was a kid that sort of put me on a path of recognizing that there are mutualities, but also.
That's okay. Well, I'm asking you to talk publicly about spirituality and how that worked with you as a researcher, and that could cause anyone to have a cough.
Well, maybe that's it. But no, I don't mind. I'm not a religious person, but I am, I think, what's properly called a spiritual person. I think that, that we arrive here kind of as blank slate, and there is something that gets written on us by experience and a lot by education and so on. But in my case, as I said, I sort of escaped the indoctrination stage, and so I'm kind of a mild iconoclast. I don't care very much about most of the dogma stuff. It's just not interesting. And I'm actually still the curious kid, and I think I'll die that way, because there's so much interesting stuff about this world that we live in, and I think I consider one evidence of being, I don't know how you said it exactly, being partly a spiritual and traveler in this business, I see a whole lot of evidence in my life. One chapter in my book, Connected, is designed by coincidence. There are so many things that had to happen just so. In my life and experience, for me to be sitting here talking to Deborah Katz. It's like a marvelous sequence of coincidences that are close enough to synchronicities to make me, think there is some sort of aspect of the universe that's guiding what's happening. So I went to northern Vermont. There I met people who turned me on to Sufism, and I became a kind of what I called a practicing non-Sufi, which is a term of respect. And then when I got to Princeton, I became a kind of acolyte of serious investigation of things that many people consider unserious, but actually which are at their base, at their most fundamental level. These things are spiritual in their nature. They are part of what we are, or part of what shapes us to be the human spiritual traveler.
Yeah. Can you talk just a little bit about the relationship that the Peer Lab had with SRI? Oftentimes there's so much in the literature about the research that was done at Stanford Research Institute and the psychoenergetics program and all the work with Targ and Pudoff and Ingo. What was your relationship, and why do we so oftentimes more hear about that lab than the peer lab?
In the most practical human sense, we had a fine relationship with SRI and then later SAIC, mostly in the form of knowing Hal and Russ. And at one point, there was a kind of collaboration to create a target pools, photographic target pools. I don't remember the details now, but we worked together on those kinds of things. And we had resources they didn't, and they had resources we didn't, or experiences. For example, used the, can't remember the name of it, but there's a kind of pool of photographs which are rated for intensity and valence and various characteristics that help to distinguish, to help to create a target pool that has many targets that are very much unlike, so which is a desirable thing if you're creating a target pool. We did go our own way, and we did call it remote perception instead of remote viewing. And we did use, at least especially Brenda did use exactly the same protocols in her work prior to getting to the pair lab, which was judging by looking at a set of alternate pictures plus the target and some things like that. But we quickly shifted into this sort of quantitative mode, and other we didn't, I guess, share it, or maybe people didn't think it was a good idea. Like you said, some people thought that would be too restrictive and too hard-edged, or what, I can't remember the term you used. It was like too rational.
Reductionistic. Although the experimenters at SRI were really using something very similar.
Oh, yeah. Somewhat later, I don't remember the details, but at least Ed May devised, and there may have been a couple of these, a kind of quantitative judging system using some kind of information measure, which probably, you know, I think the intention was somewhat the same, although I'm not sure those methods produced an actual score. To, you might say, a quantitative rating, a quantitative declaration of how good this one is, and so forth. Yeah. I should mention, by the way, people probably don't realize this, but the effect size in the pair remote perception experiments was virtually the same as the effect size in the SRI and other, credible research programs. The same. It was like 0.3, 0.35, something like that.
You mentioned that you knew Ingo Swann. Could you talk a little bit about that? Do you have like one or two memories that stand out the most?
We would find each other at the same meetings or conferences every now and then. I can't claim to have been a close friend, so I didn't visit his studio in New York, but we talked occasionally, and I had on my answering machine, which had a tape kind of digital tape system, I had a message from Ingo, which I kept for a really, really long time. It got accidentally erased during my move to whatever, but I really liked Ingo. He was a cool guy. He was a very clear-minded about a lot of things that are just moosh in most people.
What was the gist of the message on your machine?
Oh, just that he wanted to say hello and call me back so we can talk a bit.
Now, you spent many years developing the Global Consciousness Project, and we hear that term, we hear it synonymously with your name. So can you talk about that? I know there's so much to say about it, but maybe just the highlights of that program and what you felt was maybe some of like the most successful experiments.
So I don't forget it. I would like to say that the thing that's most impressive about the experiment was that it persisted and had a consistent positive result for 17 years. Okay. I mean, that's the biggest message. But I would like to start with the technology that we developed to a fine level in the intention experiments, where people tried to make it by intention to try to change the behavior of a random number generator. And when we had continuous recording of data from these devices, which happened in the early 90s, I think I might have mentioned, it became possible to go out into the field because by that time we had also miniaturized the REGs. So they're like this, they're very small. And by that time there had also developed a palm top computer that was small enough basically to put in your pocket or in a purse. And we put those together. York Dobbins made a program called PalmReg, which was a continuous recording program. The versions that were called FieldReg also. They were designed to do field research, hoping to capture some understanding of a consciousness field. So a double entendre, but a very meaningful step toward the Global Consciousness Project, which really derived out of the next step after you've done group consciousness experiments with these little field reg in my pocket and that sort of thing, finding regularly a positive answer to a prediction that there would be deviations, and that means structure, in a random trace, which is otherwise unstructured. We would see deviations when people came to be coherent with each other or have a resonant kind of group. So we thought of that as a group consciousness and did a lot of different kinds of tests of the idea of group consciousness affecting these devices, including some wonderful things like going with a shaman to a sacred site that he was going to do healing for and discovering a trace that's like off the scale, so strongly deviant that I had been trying to explain what we're doing, and he said, thank you. He didn't understand. He said, when he looked at that picture, he said, now I know what you're talking about.
Wow. And was that right when he was doing his healing?
Exactly. He did a 20-minute long healing. I marked the beginning on my data stream. The index, this continuous data had an index. So I marked the beginning and the end, and that 20-minute period was like that. And he was serious about it. His mission was to heal this was Devil's Tower, a remarkable natural monument in northeastern Wyoming. It's beautiful, and it's a sacred site long since for the Native Americans. But many of those sacred sites have been sort of unconsciously, foolishly desecrated by people who don't know what's going on. And his mission was to heal the wounds from that kind of invasion. So, yeah. And I also went to Egypt, and I got a data set which is unbelievably strong and clear. It has an effect size that's maybe half again or twice as big as all the rest of the field REG experiments on average, and four times bigger than the experiments in the lab with it. So anyway, group consciousness work set me up to think about bigger groups like, how about the whole world?
I want to hear about that, but can you talk a little bit more about what was going on in Egypt? Where exactly were you and what was happening at that time you got that really large effect?
I went there with a group of 19 altogether, 17 of whom were like me, kind of spiritual seekers. We were all deeply interested in and respectful of the ancient Egyptians' practices and understandings and so forth. And so in one way to think of it is we tried to get into that frame of mind. After not too long, I was wearing a galabeah and turban, which is a very practical thing for that part of the world anyway. And my friend Charles Overby was just like me, also. We wanted to be, you know, engaged and deeply involved. Meanwhile, I had set up this protocol where I would take data continuously, and I would mark the beginning of our visits to the sacred, the holy of holies of the temple ruins, or places like the Queen's Chamber inside the Great Pyramid, or the chamber between the paws of the Sphinx, and so on. So these, I took data all the time, and after the first couple of attempts trying to be two places at once, I realized that I couldn't do that. So I had to turn on a robotic part, which would take notes and poke buttons while I enjoyed the experience of meditating in the Holy of Holies or chanting with the group. So, yeah, we visited all of the temple ruins that we could, which some we couldn't because they were forbidden. The authorities considered too dangerous for foreigners to travel in certain parts of Egypt. Karnak, the incredible temples there, tiny little temple that had a statue of Sekhmet, which I loved so much that I went back there a second time, taking data all the time, marking the beginning and the end of all the occasions. So, I lived in the analytical world after coming back, that plus a kind of scholarly research world in the library stacks, trying to get more information about various aspects of the Egyptian cultures. But ultimately, I put together a whole database of the events where we were taking data in several categories. We were just in the neighborhood. We were there, but not chanting or meditating. We were there, and we were doing the best we could to do a kind of priest-like sacred ritual.
And were there certain locations where you had a higher effect?
Yes, the places where we did meditations and chanting had the highest effect. A little bit lower than that, but not significantly different, was the effect size for places like the Holy of Holies in the temples where we didn't have a group activity. And then further down, and now significantly lower in effect size, were events like a meeting in the boat, in the ship, to decide what we were going to do next, and shopping in the bazaar, that sort of stuff, just clatter. You know, those kinds of things didn't produce much of an effect, which is the prediction that I had made ahead of time and would make always, because the group consciousness effect really depends upon a group resonance and, you know, coherence. And if you're in a bazaar, even though you got your friends around, it's like being on a street corner or shopping mall here. There's no coherence.
So then you moved to larger, like, world projects. So was that where you handed out a bunch of these devices, and then the devices were still feeding into one central computer? Is that how it would work?
That's right, yeah. There was a year or more of development. About a year. My son, what happened to be he wasn't at loose ends, but he didn't have five jobs or a girlfriend or whatever. And so he created the architecture for the software. I had gathered friends to talk about, you know, what kind of protocol shall we follow and so forth, and put together a kind of prospectus. How do we do this? And because what we recognized was it would be a tremendously good idea to make a permanent, ongoing data set that happened to be a whole bunch of random number generators distributed around the world, because I was influenced by having read Teilhard de Chardin decades before, when I was a college student. And I was impressed by by many things about him, but his idea of the noosphere, which is a kind of sheath of intelligence for the Earth, he predicted that was the next stage of human evolution. We would become, he said, a layer of intelligence to take care of the Earth. So I thought maybe I really thought he was right. I mean, we were spiritually on the same track, and he was far advanced, of course. But I thought it was worth a shot at trying to capture some early evidence.
How would you say results were for the overall project?
Well, the overall result for the 17-year experiment, which had 500 separate tests of the general hypothesis, that has a z-score of more than 7. That means the same thing as this so-called 7 sigma result. It's so far from what's expected of random numbers, or a matrix of random numbers in this case, that it's should qualify as a finding of truth about the universe. In physics, if you have a 5 sigma result, it is said to be, you know, a done deal. You got it. Now, the Higgs boson, for example, they declared the Higgs boson not only exists, but we have found it. We have captured it. and their data had a 5 sigma kind of quality to it. So we're in the realm of highly significant departures from expectation. And it's about a database which is really a replication series. It has 500 repetitions of the same experiment with a little bit different objects and exact parameters, but definitely the same experiment done 500 times.
I've heard stories that during certain global events or national events, such as 9/11, that it did register an effect. Can you give some examples?
The average effect size is 0.33, and significance is 1.6, roughly, right? So a lot of the events are something close to 2/3 of the events are in the right direction. We made a prediction. It will go this way. And 2/3 of the time, we're right about that. So that's one thing. The composite, when you take even a very small, like 0.33 standard deviations, and multiply that by the square root of 500, you get a big number. You get a number like 7, right? So the individual events may or may not be significant the way we think of it. 9/11 was. It had a probability, a likelihood of being what it was in the actual precise prediction that we made. It was about 2 parts in 100. Okay, so that's significant. But one of my friendly skeptic friends said, that's not very impressive for such a monster event. But we did a lot of extra analysis for that and other special events. And we found, by looking at a longer time span, that it wasn't just the 4 hours and 10 minutes that we identified as the formal event. It was 3 days. Departure from expectation started a little before the first plane hit and continued for more than 2 days after. So that's powerful. That's probably, I haven't actually done an analysis to see if there's another one like that, but I think maybe there isn't. Even though we've had other very powerful events like the earthquake and tsunami in Fukushima in Japan, and also the Indian Ocean. In Haiti, the earthquake that killed 250,000 people. Those kinds of things really pay it there. I'll put it this way. My network, the Global Consciousness Network, pays attention to those kinds of things. But it also pays attention to things that are much nicer, things like New Year's. So we made early on a prediction that the 10-minute period around New Year's would be different. And Dean Radin did a separate kind of prediction for that, which I then took up and used for all the subsequent New Year's. And his prediction was that the device variance, the variability of the individual devices, would decrease starting before the main tremor of the earthquake and then return. And so we've been making that prediction for all those 17 years. And sure enough, there is, if you put them all together, you get a pattern like a V-shape where the device variance decreases, getting close to midnight, minimizes, goes to its least extreme value at midnight, and then it comes back up.
You know, we have so many unpleasant, whether it's disasters or these political events, or, you know, we're all like constantly on TV, we're all listening to events happening with Trump and his trials. And, you know, we get into sync over the just, you know, even with the different wars going on right now, you know, even though they're in far off countries, we're all dialed into them through the TV. So how does that work with both these stressful negative events and positive? Is there some kind of difference or it's all the same?
If it was a single event, I'd probably hesitate, or I would say, you know, one event doesn't give you enough information. But this is many events, many times asking the same question and getting an answer that's roughly that. It isn't always exactly like that. But what it looks like is that we like to use the a metaphor of buoys in the ocean. They're bobbing up and down and up and down. And if you get a really powerful wave, like a tsunami coming along, they'll suddenly start synchronizing. They'll all go up and down at the same time. And if they are, if it's just rough seas, they'll be bobbing whatever which way and not coordinated at all. So this is a coordinated. This is like you see these many devices being affected in such a way that they react similarly. So they all calm down. The choppy seas become, they're still choppy, but it's kind of weak choppiness, right? I'm not 100% sure. I wouldn't try to make money on, go to the bank with this, but I think that there really is a potential calming effect of certain kinds of things. And you can think about it in terms of what are people doing at New Year's. Nothing particularly spectacular, maybe talking and having dancing, and but getting close to midnight, they start becoming kind of coherent more. Their togetherness increases with a real focus on midnight itself. Such a sharp, it's completely abstract notion that this moment matters, but it does in our consciousness. It matters. So we all come together and lift a glass together or get a hug or kiss our loved ones or whatever. And it's synchronized by this abstract event in time. And our random number generator devices are remarkably responsive when we become coherent, when we resonate with each other. it captures the REGs into the same matrix of interaction.
This is the key, right? That if we all decide we want to have this compassion and all move in the same direction, but that's the key. What do you do when there's portions of society that maybe are not deciding that, or it's more, you know, one man for himself? How do you convince them that that's good for them?
I'm afraid I have to sort of beg ignorance. In spite of looking at that question all these years, I have not found much difference that's, you know, easy to identify between the poles of positive versus negative valence events. There are a few, I've done categorical analysis trying to find out what matters. There are some things that do, like, for example, fear is a fairly strong predictor if something is a fearful event. But much stronger are some positive emotions, love and compassion. If I go through all the data and identify and ask about an event, does this evoke or embody a lot of compassion? High, low, not at all, and just do that for the whole set of events. There's a lot of events that do evoke a lot of compassion. Those are the ones that produce a stronger effect than almost anything else. It's like the difference between high compassion and little or no compassion is highly significant. It's like 2 parts in 10,000 or something. So that means there are some kinds of things that really matter. Things like distance don't matter very much, unless if this is complicated, but it's sort of worth just mentioning. If events are truly global in scope, all of the pairs of random number generators show roughly the same level of correlation. But if it's a small event that is known to and participated in or like recognized by only a small number of people, maybe because it's in one country, a small country, then we do see that pairs of random number generators that are closer to each other actually are more likely to be highly correlated. Okay, so in other words, if it's a small event, distance matters, but if it's a truly global event, it doesn't. But compassion and love are emotions that are connecting us. You don't generally do compassion without having somebody to be compassionate toward or with. I mean, people talk about being, you know, self-compassion, but in general, compassion is a connecting kind of emotion. And that's what we're talking about here, is a kind of connection among and between people, even though we don't know about it. It's completely unconscious. And one of my hopes is that we'll figure out some way to educate ourselves to recognize this unconscious connection and bring it up into awareness, so that we will, create a new kind of humanity, one that's more internally connected, more properly connected with each other, and kind of literally all part of the same species, or the same, this is the only home we have, and we all share it. So we are in deep need of a deeper connection than we have. We have to figure out how to do that. I think, you know, there are a lot of people who talk about conscious evolution. We can do that. What that means is to decide what's next, to decide where we're going, to decide how we're evolving, okay? And then go ahead and do it. That we can do, we will do, as soon as we learn about and become aware and capitalize on this unconscious connection that we already share.
Yeah, I was reading about how one country, I think it's Malta, the president doesn't look at the success of the country by how much money it has, but precisely on the wellness, the happiness of the people, and they're considered one of the happiest populations.
Referring to Bhutan, they have a happiness index. Yeah. Oh, actually, there is a happiness index that is more widely, widespread. And it turns out that Finland is at the top of the happiness index, according to that particular measure. And if you read about it, you say, that makes a lot of sense. It makes so much sense, Why can't we just do that? I think it's because of miseducation. And a dear friend from 1,000 years ago, or whatever number of lifetimes, he said many times that we have issues and problems, and what we need is education. And the best way to achieve that re-education is through educational musical comedy. And yet, of course, it's easy to understand what that means. Music is a language that we all understand, no matter what our culture is or what the language is that we speak. Music comes right in, and it goes right straight to the heart. It makes us dance. It makes us move and touch each other. And comedy, it's almost the same kind of thing. If you say, if you tell a joke, of course, it does require that, speak the same language, but people laugh. And when we are laughing, we're really very much together. We're in the same universe.
I have a good friend who loves musicals. We used to be in musicals together in high school. And we would always say, what if just all of life was always a musical? Like, what if you didn't talk, you just had to sing to each other when you related? And it would be hard to be mad at each other.
You're a likely candidate. We have to recruit you into the educational musical comedy team. There are people doing that kind of stuff. I don't think any of them I don't think anybody directly perceives that what they're doing is like the forerunner of educational musical comedy. But all over Europe especially, but there are some people in this country too, there's a kind of understanding that we come together in a way that's very important and ultimately essential for our survival, based on messages that can be transmitted by music and by laughter.
What about sports? Have you tested sporting events like the Super Bowl and other big games, and was there an effect?
It's a good question. A lot of people have a kind of ingoing expectation that sports, because there's so many people in the stadium and so many whatever. But the difference between, I will say that we have looked at World Cup soccer. That's a massive world scale gathering of people into two competing camps, generally speaking. And that's a difference between what makes a difference on the global consciousness scale or not. New Year's, everybody is in one bailiwick. Everybody is waiting for the hug. But in World Cup soccer. So the result is occasionally we get really a strong effect during a major game, and everybody said, hurrah, you see, after all. But the average over asking that question many times, which you can do with the global consciousness data, it's all there. It can be downloaded for every soccer game, and you can pile them all up and do a fabulous analysis. Peter Bancel did that for two World Cup soccer years. And the first one had a marginal significance. The second one, not at all. He came to the conclusion, which didn't surprise me because I had seen this sort of thing in individual cases, that it's not the sort of thing that's going to that turns on the Global Consciousness Project network.
Wow. And you think it really is because there's two competing teams.
If you talk about coherence and then you talk about competition, even though you may have two coherent teams, there's a kind of mashup that doesn't look like, doesn't feel like coherence.
I heard recently that you had handed the Global Consciousness Project over to the HeartMath people. Could you talk about that? How did that come about and how is that going to look or work?
Years ago, I became conscious, more conscious as years passed, that I wouldn't do this forever. And I thought it was a pretty good thing to do anyway, so I needed somebody else. And I checked with a couple of people and, well, one other person, but he was not, he didn't think it would be possible for him to do it. You know? But Roland McCrady is an old friend, and we meet each other at conferences and shared a whole lot of kind of understanding of how the world works and how nice it is to have data about things like how does the heart relate to the mind or the brain? And what about Schumann resonances? And what about global consciousness? And so anyway, I asked Roland one day if he might possibly be interested in taking it up and continuing the program. And in the meantime, we have been gathering with a group of about 12 or so people from HeartMath and IONS and the Global Consciousness Project, and a couple of, you know, some people from no organization in particular. And we had, it's now operational. The GCP2, or GCP 2.0, as we sometimes call it, is operational. It has about on the order of 200 nodes in a network, and each of those has four random number generators on it, or at it. And we're doing things like shipping up the raw noise, not the conditioned bits only, but the raw noise actually, to form a database of that nature for people who hope to discover what it is about global consciousness, that, you know, how does it interact with the raw noise from a diode, that sort of thing. Anyway, and we're also connecting and correlating with things like search indices, like Google's five top, whatever it is, and we're predicting correlations between that and measures of sentiment, which are used in market research, and on. They're geomagnetic variables, stuff like that. So in other words, it's a very much more comprehensive kind of data set or database. And it will certainly be way bigger, a whole lot of data. And I'm very happy.
When you look back over your whole career, is there one thing that stands out that you're most proud of?
The idea that I've been involved in creating a corpus of data that can be questioned. We can ask more questions of the database that already exists about what's the human consciousness about? Is there such a thing as global consciousness? We can ask that question any number of different ways. Has been asked already by a lot of different people using different kinds of tools. And I'm really just very proud of having created an entity like that. It's like a reliable source of potential information, or which means a reliable source of a whole kind, a lot of potential that we don't know about yet, because we haven't done enough work yet.
Yeah, when it comes to exploring consciousness, it really sounds like this body of work is really some of the leading work, just because of the so much extensive data that's been produced for so long. But what's your hope for the future? You've talked about that a little bit, just in terms of how this work can be applied?
I'd like to say something like, let's just pick up this unconscious stream and rock and roll. I mean, really, it's there's a lot about us that we don't understand. And these are tools, you know, that can advance our understanding. And we've got, you know, important work to do. If Tehar was right about this noosphere as the destination, our next, you know, our destiny as human beings, then we got work to do to live up to that and do it well. And I think we can, you know, it's like I'm an optimist from word go. And I think that's the most important question that probably any of us can ask of ourselves is, what do I do to advance the quality of life, the spiritual beingness of all the people on this planet? How do we save ourselves from our worst tendencies and grow ourselves into our best?
And if people want to learn more about the project in terms of seeing published results or anything like that, where could they do that?
Well, for English language speakers, one of the best resources, I think, is the book I wrote and published in 2019 called Connected, The Emergence of Global Consciousness. And you can get it on Barnes & Noble or that other thing. What do they call that?
Amazon.
Yeah. I don't even like to advertise them, but there we are. Anyway, and then there are two books in German, which if people are German speakers, they're kind of interesting. And one is called Der Weltgeist, and the other is Die Weltkraft in Dir. And the first one is kind of about the Global Consciousness Project and a lot of implications. And the second one is really about the implications first. What we have capacities that we don't exploit. And the book is about telling people, giving little suggestions and exercises about learning to exploit our potentials. And so there's a website, which is huge, but it has I think, excellent menu. The URL is global-mind.org. It's very simple, global-mind.org. And for GCP2, the fully live website isn't now yet running, but I think it will have the same URL as this, gcp2.net. Very simple, gcp2.net. And it already has enough sort of background information that people can get an idea, and they may even choose to become what we call a citizen scientist, participating by investing in, some money to pay the expenses of one of these fantastic devices that can be sent out into the world.
And you had mentioned that some of the equipment and experiments and machines from the Pure Lab move to another place.
Right. There is Ubiquity University, and Peter Mary is instrumental in running the Broughton Estate, which is managed, I guess, for the benefit of, at least part of it is for the benefit of Ubiquity University. They have conference facilities and that sort of thing. And they have one or more dedicated rooms for the Pear Museum, you might say, but it's also active. And they have a random number generator that they call the Weirdoscope, which people can buy for their own personal use in whatever sort of thing. It comes with software that I think it's very interesting, but maybe not well tested yet. But in any case, people can buy one of those things and buy that software package, or the device, I'm pretty sure, can be made to download device into data into, you know, Excel spreadsheets and that sort of thing. So that's a possible source for people who want to do their own experiments.
Yeah, I thought you were saying weird.
By the way, it's spelled W-Y-R-D, and it actually refers to an ancient spiritual perspective and not weirdness.
Yeah, if people are interested in receiving a device themselves, will they be able to go to the website and learn more about that?
I think I understand the question to be something like, can I get a GCP2 device and go measure what happens at my yoga session? Something like that? Probably not. Although the device has to be connected into a router, and through that connection, which is the simplest possible thing, right? It can communicate all of its data to the servers in the sky for GCP2, and it also receives from GCP2 a readout of what the whole network is seeing, whether it's coherent or not so coherent, that sort of thing. And if you're a serious analyst and computer, I guess, geek, then you can, I think you probably can learn how to download the data for your own personal device. But it still will have to be plugged into a router, which you may not have at your yoga meeting.
Right? Roger, I would love to thank you so much for all your time here. This has just been a marathon interview, and I know we can go for hours and days and years.
Well, thank you, Deborah, and I wish you Godspeed in the same kind of efforts that you're making, and I think succeeding at quite nicely, making a difference. Yeah. And if we had a little poster, it was actually a postcard sized poster on the wall in the Pear Lab that said, if we all work together, we can totally subvert the system. And I think that's probably a sensible perspective.
No, this has been wonderful. I thank you so much for being so present here and being willing to do this interview, and just for your entire body of work. You have made such a big difference in so many people's lives in so many different ways. And I thank you, and I know that they thank you.
Book 2 in the New Thinking Aloud Dialogues book series is a tribute to parapsychologist Russell Targ, celebrating his 90th birthday. New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos.